From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Will independent contractors have to become employees? You'd have to be avoiding this on purpose not to know at least a little something about AB 5. It's sitting on Governor Gavin Newsom's desk. He's expected to sign it into law. But do you know how to figure out which workers will go from being independent contractors to company employees? All you got to do is take a test that's as easy as ABC. That's coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. It's Wednesday, September 11th. Hope your day has been both thoughtful and meaningful. Coming up, we're going to find out more about an LA County plan to dispatch mental health professionals when those in distress dial 911. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. Plus, we find out more about what Trump administration officials were doing in LA yesterday to address the homelessness crisis. More on that in about 20 minutes, so stay right there. We're going to start today in Sacramento with a bill that we've talked a lot about on this show, and that's AB 5. It would reclassify an estimated 2 million California contractors as employees. The bill passed the state legislature and now heads to the desk of Governor Gavin Newsom, who is expected to sign it. The passage of the bill puts the state at odds with Uber and Lyft, two companies that depend on contractors. So what happens next for the tech titans? We're going to get some answers from Judy Lin. She's been writing about this for Cal Matters. Judy, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
Now, as I mentioned, Uber and Lyft are two major companies that would be affected by this law. Just minutes ago, Uber's chief legal officer weighed in on the bill. What did he have to say?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly was saying that they're disappointed that they weren't able to reach a compromise, but that he is going to take the governor at his word on trying to find a solution, beyond this week's bill deadlines. They're making the argument that they have in court previously that the company itself does not hire drivers, that the drivers are not their employees because they are technically just a technology platform. But this bill, AB 5, once it takes effect in January, does allow the state and even local governments to push that and challenge it and enforce it. So that's where the test is going to happen.
It almost feels, Judy, as if Uber is saying, fine, California, but we're not doing what you want us to do.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's quite a different tune than what Uber said in a statement recently. They had outlined some steps they would have to take if the bill becomes law. It's not clear now if they're going to make those moves. It doesn't sound like they will. But what are some of the possible effects for rideshare companies on this?
Yeah, so if Uber and Lyft do have to make the change, the companies have said that drivers will have more fixed shifts. Just think of being at McDonald's or Macy's. You have your hours, your 4 or 8 hours that you'd be logged on. And that's just a byproduct of being forced to pay a minimum wage. They also say that they would have to limit the number of drivers who are signed on because they wouldn't want to be paying workers while they're idling and waiting for the next ride. The third thing is they say that they could reduce driver incentives. They dangle higher payouts for drivers in certain areas when demand is high.
Yeah, and so when you said the words fixed shifts, Judy, it goes contrary to what we've always believed is the kind of advantage of being an Uber driver, that you get to just choose whenever you want to work.
Yeah, and that's exactly their argument for why some kind of solution needs to come out from Sacramento, whether it's through Governor Newsom or the legislature. They need a new framework that will work for the new economy.
What are some of the ideas that Uber and Lyft have floated out there to maybe try to avoid being affected by the bill?
Yeah, so in the last hours of the legislative cycle, we see all sorts of proposals being thrown out. There was language circulated that would create a new class of workers. They'd be called network drivers. They'd be offered three things: a wage floor that's above the minimum wage, portable benefits to cover insurance and sick days. And this idea, this is a new concept of what's called sectoral bargaining. It's like collective bargaining, but it's used in Europe where you essentially negotiate with the whole entire industry instead of company by company. And you know, Uber and Lyft would like that better, so they don't have to compete with each other.
Talking to Judy Lin, economy reporter for Cal Matters. Now, the signing of AB5 would put the state of California somewhat at odds with the federal government because it still categorizes Uber and Lyft drivers as freelancers. How so?
Yeah, this is a kind of a tricky one to thread here. So the state now would under AB5 would classify gig workers as employees,
right.
But the federal government under the Trump administration says that gig workers are freelancers. So there's this weird quirk where when the National Labor Relations Act doesn't cover workers, then only then can states act to provide the right to organize. So there's this thinking from the Newsom administration and some labor leaders that this could be a framework for having the state turn those workers into employees by, you know, constructing our own classification. But it's not clear if Uber or Lyft have this in mind, if they support it, because this is still just an idea. And you know, as Tony West is saying in the call, that they want a whole new construct.
Now, the bill would go into effect January 1st, New Year's Day. Even with money for a ballot measure, there's a window in which they'll have to comply. As far as how Uber and Lyft work with their drivers, what might they do now?
This is one where it'll be messy.
Yeah.
For now, they won't see anything. You know, your typical Uber or Lyft driver wouldn't see much change, but you can see San Francisco or Los Angeles or, you know, even the Attorney General start to weigh in and push Uber and Lyft to change their classification, and that invites a whole legal battle. So, you know, if you're a driver, you want to sit tight. There's not an immediate change, but you'd probably want to be paying attention to what your local prosecutors are going to do.
Yeah, Judy Lin is economy reporter for Cal Matters. Judy, thanks a lot for the time.
Thank you.
AB5, if signed, will affect more than just drivers, though. There's a whole lot of other jobs that aren't related to ride-hail apps, where contract workers might become employees of the companies they do business with. Here to give us some examples, we have KPCC business reporter David Wagner. David, hi.
Hey, good to be here.
All right, first, let's start with jobs and businesses that will get exemptions under AB5. That means people who work in fields that would not automatically classify them as employees for a business.
Yeah, this bill has been amended quite a few times, so there's a long list of exemptions at this point. Some of them include highly paid medical jobs, like we've got doctors, surgeons, and dentists on that exemptions list. Other workers who shouldn't be affected include lawyers, architects, graphic designers, real estate agents, and barbers and hairstylists. And, you know, the general idea here with all these different workers is people who really do act as small businesses should be allowed to keep doing business as usual. You know, as long as they're able to set their own rates, set their own hours, work with customers directly, and take their business to whoever they want to work with, they shouldn't have to become anyone's employee.
Now, did lawmakers give carve-outs to any other workers who were pushing for exemptions?
Yeah, so let's talk about freelance writers and photographers. These are workers who've been pretty concerned about AB5. They've worried about it leading to their work drying up. But the current bill does allow them to file up to 35 submissions each year with a single media outlet before they would have to be considered an employee. That might work for some freelancers. You know, some people may never exceed that cap. But for freelancers who maybe have a weekly column or who publish their work in just a handful of outlets every year, this could impose new limits on their work. We've heard from smaller newspapers that really rely on freelancers. They've not been happy with this bill. We should say, though, that the newspaper industry did win one more exemption yesterday when legislators passed a one-year exemption for newspaper delivery workers.
All right, now let's hear about some of the categories of jobs where employers might have to make their workers into employees. Which companies have no exemptions?
Yeah, the highest profile fight over this bill has really been centered on those gig platforms like Uber, Lyft, DoorDash. But those are actually a pretty small fraction of all the independent contract workers in the state. So we've heard from other kinds of workers and employers that have been pushing for exemptions without any luck. For instance, truckers who own and operate their own vehicles, they've been saying this could force them to shut down or move out of state. Lawmakers have really highlighted in considering this bill some abuses that truckers have seen under this model, especially at LA ports. But there are some truckers out there who prefer to work this way. And these are the kind of workers who are out there hauling the stuff we buy online, whether it's, you know, food, retail goods. Changes for those workers could end up meaning changes for consumers.
Now, we're also in Hollywood, which is basically an industry composed almost entirely of freelancers. Are there certain jobs where the worker might have to be an employee?
That can get kind of complicated. So Hollywood is a really heavily unionized industry, and we've actually seen some entertainment workers unions sign on to AB5. They've endorsed it. So we've heard from SAG-AFTRA, who said that the bill really shouldn't change anything about how its actors work with producers, how they set up their business for tax purposes. But for other non-union entertainment workers, this could get tricky. Music industry executives have said that this could drive independent artists out of the state. They've said that, you know, musicians are out there collaborating with a lot of different kind of workers. They work with producers, engineers, publicists, music video directors. And they've said that all of those relationships could become more legally challenging.
Now, the tricky thing about this law, at least for people here, is that LA is a city made up a lot of freelancers. Some might want to stay a freelancer instead of becoming an employee. So what's the rule of thumb so people can find out if their job, if their own job, might be affected?
The new rule here for deciding who is a real independent contractor and who's an employee is called the ABC rule. And it was actually established by a California Supreme Court decision last year. This bill is really just trying to codify that decision, making it more clear-cut who exactly is affected. Workers have to pass three tests under this ABC rule to be a true independent contractor. And there's one that's pretty hard for some workers to pass. It says this, that workers have to be performing work that falls outside the company's usual course of business to be an independent contractor. So, you know, for example, a restaurant could hire a plumber to come in as an independent contractor and fix their pipes. That's fine. But if they hired a chef as a contract worker, that would not be allowed.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, finally, is there an opt-out provision in the law? If I wanted to stay a contract employee with a company, could I do that?
Yeah, I've spoken with a number of, you know, Uber and Lyft drivers out there who would probably prefer that. Some workers really do want to stay independent contractors. But no, the law here is pretty clear. If you don't pass that test, if you don't qualify as an independent contractor under these strict new rules, you should be considered an employee.
David Wagner is KPCC's business reporter. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And just a quick note that we are watching another labor-related bill that's making its way through the legislature, Assembly Bill 378, which would allow childcare workers to unionize and engage in collective bargaining, is nearing final passage before being sent to Governor Gavin Newsom's desk. We will keep you updated on that one. All right, when police respond to 911 calls, they have to be ready to handle just about anything. But sometimes it can be unfair to put officers in situations that require a very specific set of skills, ones that might not have training for. I mean, think about it. A fire? Sure, a cop could help, but a firefighter would be ideal. Coming up, why in LA County that rationale will now apply when someone is having a mental health crisis. Find out how when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Dial 911 in LA County and you just might summon a new kind of emergency vehicle. Earlier this week, the LA County Board of Supervisors, along with the county's mental health and sheriff's departments, teamed up to show off two new types of response vehicles. They'll be used to respond when someone is in the midst of a mental health crisis instead of sending traditional law enforcement. LA County Supervisor Catherine Barger joins us now for more. Supervisor, welcome back to Take Two.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. This is an exciting program that we're rolling out.
All right, so let's start with the here and now. What sort of vehicle currently shows up when someone calls 911 with a situation that clearly involves mental health?
We have what we call mental evaluation teams. They pair a sheriff's deputy with a psych social worker, and they roll out on regular sheriff's vehicles that are unmarked, but they are sheriff's vehicles that roll out on these calls.
Okay, so why did the county decide it needed to respond differently going forward?
Well, actually, I mean, you know, to the sheriff's credit, this is something that their mental evaluation team has recognized has been a complaint coming out of the community as it relates to treating these individuals like criminals. And when I met with cities like Burbank, that was one of their criticisms, is that they have to take people in their squad cars, and they are not being arrested. They're simply being sent to the hospital. And so they requested a more compassionate way of transporting individuals that are in crisis. And we heard them loud and clear. And if you look at the numbers with the mental evaluation team, and I think this is important to understand, that when the mental evaluation team is called out, 98% of the individuals they come in contact with do not end up in our jails. They end up in a hospital or in the care of professionals. So we are diverting individuals that may end up in our jails, and they're actually getting the care they need.
So you're not treating it as a crime. You're not criminalizing it right off the bat.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when I started, when I was elected by the board or by the people and came on the board, we had 8 mental evaluation teams. Today we have 33, and it is continuing to grow because the success we see with this program going out and de-escalating situations that could end up being a serious crime against an individual that truly does have mental illness. It's a win-win. It's a win for the community. It's a win for the families. It's a win for the individual that's in crisis.
Talking to LA County Supervisor Catherine Barger, on Monday, you showed off two new kinds of vehicles that the county will use to respond to mental health crises. First, let's start with the therapeutic transport van. Tell us more about how it's equipped and staffed and in what situations it's going to be used.
So we are rolling out 10, and they are the therapeutic transport vans, and there's going to be 2 located strategically in each of the supervisorial districts. Residents will have access to the service at any location, so it will be ready to roll. We're going to strategically locate them in areas where they will be able to roll throughout the county. These vans will be staffed with a trained clinician and a peer specialist, but they'll also be able to telemedicine a psychiatrist, if need be, to be a part of the overall care of that individual that's in that van. It also provides space for a family member. If a family member needs to come with that individual when they're being transported. And it truly is about providing a therapeutic atmosphere and not treating the individual like they've committed a crime.
And it's clearly marked. I mean, I'm looking at a picture of it right now. It says Los Angeles County Department of Health very clearly on the side. It's in the county colors, too, so there's no mistaking what it's there for.
And it's important that we break the stigma as well. I mean, you know, time and time again, it's like, why is it marked? There is no stigma attached to being in crisis or having a mental illness. I know in my circle of friends, we all know somebody who has either gone through or has a family member who has gone through or is going through issues as it relates to mental health. And it's not just schizophrenia, bipolar. It can be depression. Depression leads to suicide.
Now, the other one, though, is an unmarked van. What more can you tell us about that one and why a second type of vehicle is needed?
So there's going to be 2 ways that you're going to end up coming in contact with them. The first is via 911. And 911 is what is usually where the mental evaluation team is rolling out. They could, in fact, come in contact with the individual and recognize that the therapeutic van is more appropriate, and then they would be called out. And the therapeutic van can be accessed through calling 1-800-854-7771. And so when the mental evaluation team comes out and the individual is, let's say, violent, the new 250 medium roof vans that we rolled out will be used. And they have, for the safety of the client, but also the safety of the law enforcement, like a cage, if you will, that is very much open space, so they're not being transported in handcuffs. They're, in fact, in an area where they are protected, and the public's protected, but it's not about, putting them in shackles and sending them to the jail.
And Supervisor, because it's unmarked, is it more of kind of a discreetness kind of thing where you protect privacy a little bit?
Well, I mean, yes and no. But yes, obviously, privacy is important, but it's more about breaking the stigma. These individuals are not criminals. So when the mental evaluation team is transporting somebody to a hospital, they shouldn't have to be transported in a marked police car. Just like when you go to the hospital in an ambulance, this is about getting them the care they need, but also being compassionate and recognizing that they are not criminals.
And air conditioned, fully air conditioned, right? Because it does get hotter. Yeah.
Yeah, both. It really is almost like a mobile jail.
Yeah.
Only probably nicer than our men's central jail, quite frankly. But that's for a whole other show.
That's another issue entirely, Supervisor. No, I don't know if you want to get into that right now.
But the goal is to have patients see no metal bars.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Really de-escalate the situation.
Yeah. Now, give us an example of a call that might come in that would prompt 911 to dispatch this unmarked sheriff's department's van. How is it even decided that that the situation involves a mental health crisis?
Well, the triage takes place on the street. So when the sheriffs come in contact with an individual and they recognize that this person, let's say, since homelessness seems to be continually being talked about, and that's a passion of mine as it relates to the mentally ill, let's say that the sheriffs come in contact with someone who is homeless, mentally ill, displaying odd behavior, and is been called by a business that wants to address the concern. The sheriff may go out, come in contact, and recognize that this is something the mental evaluation team can handle, call up the mental evaluation team. If this individual is not violent, they can either choose to call in the therapeutic transport van and or they can simply talk to the individual, figure out what's going on, talk to them about getting treatment or services, and determine whether or not they can or should be taken to a hospital and what they call 5150, considering themselves a danger to self or others. And then they'll just transport them and follow the process through and actually ensure that this individual gets the care they need. And then we come in as a county, and we ensure that once that person gets the care, they don't end up back on the street.
That's L.A. County Supervisor Catherine Barger. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. The Washington Post reported Tuesday that President Trump was pushing for a crackdown on homeless encampments in California and considering moving people off the streets and into government-run facilities. Now, it's unclear exactly what the administration might do, if anything, but White House officials were in Los Angeles this week to learn more about the city's efforts to address homelessness. KPCC housing reporter Matt Tinoco is here to tell us more about it. Hello, Matt.
Hi.
All right. Do we know who exactly was here from the administration and what they did during their visit?
So I know that there were representatives from the Department of Justice, the EPA, the Health and Human Services Administration, then the Housing and Urban Development Department, and then also the VA, the Veterans Administration. Okay. They showed up on Monday and have basically been meeting with local officials and seeing what exactly is happening on the ground in Los Angeles on homelessness. I know that they toured Skid Row and some of the City of LA homeless shelter and housing facilities. I also know that they met with the union heads of both the LAPD and County Sheriff Department unions. And then the LA Times also reported they went out to Pomona. All told, that everybody I've spoken with is basically saying it's a fact-finding mission to figure out what is going on and to see exactly what conditions are like on the ground.
Okay. Now, it probably should be not news to anyone that L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti and President Trump are not exactly on great terms, quite the opposite. They've traded jabs in the past about homelessness and immigration, and many critics have seen this visit as politicking, kind of a move to showcase the homelessness problem and to make California and its Democratic leaders look bad. So how should we read this trip? And actually, what has Garcetti said about the visit?
I don't know exactly how to read this trip. I know the Washington Post was saying that they were promising to crack down on homelessness, but nobody I've talked with locally has said that there's anything resembling a plan here. I think there is an attempt at politicking, but like, I mean, homelessness isn't just a blue state issue, is it? It's especially bad here on the West Coast. Yeah. But cities all over the country are dealing with this, and it's an affordable housing crisis everywhere, and that causes homelessness everywhere. And then, I mean, for that matter, locally in the state of California, some of the biggest increases in homelessness were in the Central Valley cities, which that remains a decisively red part of California.
Now, what about the mayor? You mentioned that you caught up with the mayor.
Yeah. So I caught up with him this morning, and he said that he would welcome federal support on the issue. But then he also pushed back on anything that would resemble just bulldozing encampments, sort of like that Washington Post headline, and moving people into government camps.
If it's about coming here to be able to blame or suspend the Constitution to move people unlawfully from the sidewalk, we'd remind them that doesn't adhere to the law, and politics doesn't house anybody, resources does.
All right, now Andy Bales from the Union Rescue Mission, someone we've had on the show here, and a longtime advocate for the homeless, helped lead the tour with Trump administration officials yesterday. He joined Air Talk earlier, and he really took an optimistic view of the visit.
It sent 15 officials from several different important departments, and face-to-face with very good professional people, I was told this is not about politics. We are here to help people.
Okay, Matt, what do you think?
Bales was one of the people who met with them and talked with them. I think my main thought is that this is one of the first times in recent years that the federal government is actually talking about homelessness. And the issue is getting national headlines because of this visit. It's, you know, it's just been ignored for so long. I think it's a good thing that there's national attention on it.
At least, right? I mean, that couldn't be a bad thing, at least I would think. Now, we know from your reporting, Matt, that most of the funding to address homelessness in LA comes from our own tax dollars through Measure H and also from state and county funding. What exactly is the federal government's role currently on this?
So the federal government does disperse money to local homeless service and homeless housing programs, mostly in the form of grants, mostly from the Housing and Urban Development Department. There are also some resources that come down from the Veterans Administration specifically for homeless veterans. All of this money gets rolled into the state and local resources that are also in this sort of homeless services sector. But the thing is that the federal resources are less than what is provided by the state and then also the county of Los Angeles. So if you want the hard numbers, the feds last year in 2018 contributed about $150 million to Los Angeles County towards ending homelessness. The state tossed in about $170 million. But then the big one, by contrast, are the resources from voter-approved Measure H, which is raising about $400 million each year.
Now, I know we don't have much clarity on what the administration actually will do in terms of reducing homelessness in LA, but what could they do, Matt? I mean, what would experts on the subject like them to do, maybe?
I think, as I was calling around on this the past day, I think the thing that I heard most often, basically when I asked exactly that question, is that everybody wishes the feds would expand the low-income housing program. That's the Section 8 housing vouchers. Those are basically vouchers for poor renters, and then they subsidize their income so that they can afford an apartment, which maybe they wouldn't be able to do otherwise. And basically, people are saying that they wish the feds would actually fund the program enough to meet the truly enormous need that is out there. This is one of the things that Garcetti said to me today, actually, just about public assistance.
If you have a disability, you get it. If you have a low income level and you need to eat, you get food stamps. These are entitlements, but Section 8 is a lottery, and 75% of the people lose that lottery, and many of them hit the streets.
And that 75% number is actually nationally. In LA County, it's more like 88%.
Wow.
Yeah. So in LA County, we have about 94,000 housing vouchers in circulation. The thing is that there are 760,000 households with an income that's low enough to qualify them for that program.
Now, I know another thing related are efforts at the state level to put some safety measures in for renters. Can you fill us in on where those efforts stand?
Yeah, basically, those are tenant protections, things like things that will, you know, limit how much rent can increase year over year. And then other things, it's called just cause eviction, which basically says a landlord can't just, like right now in the state of California, a landlord can serve a tenant with a 60-day notice to leave in most parts of the state, and there's very little that the tenant can do to contest it. The proposal at the state level right now is it's called AB 1482. It's actually being heard by the state assembly today, and it would limit the amount of rent that can increase in a year to the consumer price index plus 5%, so typically around 7 to 8% in a year. And then it would also do that eviction protection that I mentioned. It's being heard this afternoon in the state assembly, and that's the last hurdle before it goes to the government's desk. And he has said that he would be up to sign it.
All right, that's KPCC's Matt Tinoco. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, there seems to be a consistent video streaming theme at play here. You've probably heard about Disney Plus and all the company's content on Netflix, such as Marvel movies, that will now exclusively be seen on their upcoming platform. But now we're finally hearing some details about Apple TV Plus. Now, they don't have that gigantic library of movies like Disney's. Coming up, we're going to tell you what they will have to show you, me, and everyone else, including what it's all going to cost. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC, I'm A. Martinez. Apple's press event included the usual announcements about its iPhone and other products, but also revealed long-awaited details surrounding its streaming service, plus a box office comeback for Jennifer Lopez. Let's go on the lot.
Hey, shut up! God, I wish...
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rosebud. The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is our guide as always. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, A.
All right, so yesterday we finally got more details about TV Plus. That's Apple's long-awaited streaming service.
Our mission for Apple TV Plus is to bring you the best original stories from the most creative minds in television and film. Stories that help you find inspiration, that are grounded in emotion, truly stories to believe in, stories with purpose.
That's Apple CEO Tim Cook introducing TV Plus during yesterday's keynote. So, Rebecca, what are the details?
Well, we know now that this service will launch on November 1st. Perhaps the most eyebrow-raising thing we learned yesterday was the price. Apple's TV Plus will be the cheapest streaming service out there at $5 a month. And if you buy a piece of Apple hardware, you'll get a year of the service for free. That compares to $13 a month for Netflix and $5 a month for Disney Plus.
Gotta admit, it was nice seeing that price, Rebecca. I was expecting a lot more, probably would have been willing to pay a lot more.
Well, the interesting thing is, this now raises the question, is the point of this new streaming service to create new content, or is it really to sell more phones? Because I suddenly thought my cracked 3-year-old iPhone is due for replacement if it means I'll get a year free of watching these TV shows and movies.
Now, before we get to what's going to be on TV Plus, just a quick little side note. Is it a little confusing that there are two big giant streaming services similarly named launching so close to one another? I mean, that can't be a coincidence, can it?
Well, yeah, TV Plus and Disney Plus are both launching in November, which is interesting. I think they are going to be different enough that consumers will not find that confusing. It does speak to when streaming companies believe people will actually be watching, which is around the holidays. That's when binge viewing peaks. That's when people sort of hunker down at home and watch a lot of stuff on their screens.
All right. So they've got some key shows they're pushing for their launch to get people excited. What are those shows?
Well, the marquee show is a morning show starring Jennifer Aniston, Reese Witherspoon, Steve Carell. It's about a morning TV news show. They've also got this futuristic fantasy drama starring Jason Momoa called C, a documentary, Elephant Queen, some kid-friendly stuff. So they're sort of slowly building their programming. It's not a lot when you compare it to, say, Netflix, which has this enormous trove of content.
Yeah, but you said the two magic words, Jason Momoa, which means my wife has already bought it. She already has bought that thing.
She did.
Yeah, she did. Now, we've been talking a lot about how crowded the streaming landscape will be getting in the coming months. How is TV Plus making itself competitive?
Well, certainly that price is going to be enormously persuasive for people. And I think they are relying on their products, their laptops, their phones, their tablets, to get people hooked on the service. And then once people have been using it for free for a year, there will be more content on it and people will become accustomed to paying for it.
And it's almost as like Apple in this way is creating its own little ecosystem, right? It's got its own hardware and now it's got its own streaming stuff. You almost never have to leave your phone's view to exist.
Nothing would delight them more. I mean, look at the impact they've had on the way we consume music and how many people rely on Apple's music. But they would love to do the same thing for television and film.
All right, let's move on now to some developments in the Harvey Weinstein investigation. A new book out by New York Times reporters who broke the story reveals some key people in the investigation. Anyone we might know, Rebecca?
Well, one of the most interesting details for me as a reporter that came out of this book was learning that it was Gwyneth Paltrow who played a key role in their investigation. She was the first major actress to cooperate. Her cooperation played a role in persuading others. One of the anecdotes in the book is that Harvey Weinstein showed up to a party at Paltrow's house, and she was hiding in the bathroom talking on the phone to the New York Times reporters.
Wow. And just real quick, remind us of Paltrow's relationship with Weinstein before her allegations.
Gwyneth Paltrow was Harvey Weinstein's biggest star. Her career and his were completely intertwined. Her nickname was the First Lady of Miramax. She won her Oscar for his movie Shakespeare in Love.
So her going on the record on this, that's a huge deal. I mean, considering what they accomplished together.
It is, and I think the interesting thing about the way this story was put together, and I think the way a lot of Me Too stories are put together, is that oftentimes the victims kind of hold hands together and jump, and that seems to have partly been the case here. Paltrow's willingness to go on the record was persuasive for other women who were afraid.
Now, as this information came to light, Harvey Weinstein fired back at Paltrow through a spokesperson. What did Weinstein have to say?
This was a really colorful statement. The statement reads, Gwyneth Paltrow comes from Hollywood royalty. Her father was a top producer, her mother a respected and famous actor, her godfather is Steven Spielberg. She didn't need to make movies with Harvey Weinstein, she wanted to, and she won top awards and was the top paid female actor for nearly a decade with Weinstein. Her narrative of her job being at stake is just gratuitous, full of goop. Goop is, of course, a reference to Paltrow's health and wellness empire.
All right. Let's end now, then, on the box office and what some are speculating might be Jennifer Lopez's long-awaited comeback.
The game is rigged, and it does not reward people who play by the rules.
But it's like robbing a bank, except you get the keys. Are you in?
All right, so why are people saying that Hustlers will put J-Lo back on the map, Rebecca?
Believe it or not, critics love this movie. It's currently got a 95% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It's expected to open at about $25 million domestically. If it does, that would be the highest live-action opening of Jennifer Lopez's career.
Wow. So I guess when you think of Jennifer Lopez, she's so everywhere, right? That you think that she's never had a failure of any kind ever. I didn't realize her box office game had gotten so bad. What was her last success, would you say?
It's been a minute since the sort of heyday of J-Lo at the box office. Her biggest hit was Monster in Law, which was in 2005. That opened at $23 million. You know, and she made some romantic comedies. It was The Wedding Planner, The Backup Plan. Her career is sort of infamously known for the movie Gigli that she made with Ben Affleck. But she has not had a big hit recently.
How have her most recent projects been doing in comparison?
Her last movie, last year's Second Act, opened at just $6.5 million on its way to topping out at less than $40 million domestically, so not great.
Yeah, and I was one of those that paid the money to go see it. I was not too thrilled. It was not a great, great film. But for this one, for Hustlers, people are even talking about awards, possibly. I mean, do you think she'll actually take home some trophies because of Hustlers?
Well, this movie definitely says Golden Globe to me. Oscar may be a longer shot, but award season is effectively a charm offensive and a sort of case for can you work the hardest to win over the most people. That's something Jennifer Lopez seems willing and able to do.
She has shown that she can do definitely that throughout her career. Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, even here in L.A., where people are more movie savvy than anywhere else, you might not recognize the name David Koepp, but you definitely know his work. Prolific screenwriter, his films range from launching blockbuster franchises like Jurassic Park to cult classics like Death Becomes Her. Now, for the first time, add novelist to his resume. Coming up, David Koepp will tell us about a zombie fungus in his new thriller, Cold Storage. That's next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Might not recognize David Koepp by name, but you definitely know his movies. Jurassic Park, Mission Impossible, Spider-Man, Panic Room. Yeah, he wrote them all. And now, one of Hollywood's most successful screenwriters has turned to fiction with his first novel, Cold Storage, a comedic thriller about three strangers who join forces to stop a parasitic virus from taking over the world. We asked Koepp to come in studio and tell us all about it.
My name is David Koepp. I'm the author of Cold Storage. I'd been writing screenplays for a very long time. Well, it seems like a very long time. It's 30 years. 30 years is a long time. Since my mid-20s, when I started. I loved it. I do love it. I still love writing screenplays. But I had a new idea. I assumed it was a movie idea, because they always have been. I'd never written a book. I thought in passing about it. It seemed like a great deal of typing, and so I didn't do it. But this idea, I went to start writing it as a treatment. And movie treatments are these horrible documents that are like 10 pages long. And so I started writing this treatment, and I couldn't face slogging through another one of these, you know, terrible documents again to get my story idea down. So I thought, why don't I at least try to write some decent prose so that, you know, I can enjoy it a little bit more. So I wrote the first couple paragraphs, and I immediately realized this is freeing. I mean, I can talk about what people are thinking and feeling. I can digress. I can write anything I want. I was walking down the street in New York City, and there was this guy walking toward me who I guessed was maybe 24 years old, and he was in a private security guard's uniform, you know, like a polyester short sleeve shirt. And the look on his face was that he was either coming from or going to a job he hated. And I thought, what if that security guard in the job he hates has something strange happen and decides, well, I may hate this job, but it's my job. And what if that was a horror movie? And I thought that's a guy I'd watch a story about. Ophiocordyceps. There are about 200 genuses of Ophiocordyceps. The one that sort of captured the popular attention in the last few years is the so-called zombie ants. The ant is walking along merrily on the forest floor, steps in a bit of the fungus, gets some spores on it. The spores go to the brain and start to take over the brain and create the overpowering sensation in the ant that it needs to climb. So it finds the nearest blade of grass, climbs up it, clamps its jaws down on it, and waits for the developing fungus to overfill the body cavity of the ant, and then it bursts. And the reason it wants to be up on something high, like a blade of grass, is so that it can burst and spread as far as possible. This is nefarious. It's also genius, and it's also quite showy. I mean, nature sometimes has a real showbiz instinct, and this is one of those times. And I thought, that's great, and why can't I make up another genus? Wouldn't this fungus have an even better chance of spreading if it were in humans, because we're warm-blooded? So it seemed like a happy mix. My favorite character in the book is this guy, Roberto Diaz, who's a 68-year-old former government operative with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency. When his phone goes off and he's called to this, you know, back to perilous duty, it's a great conflict, because he loves this life, and the last thing he wants to do is do anything to threaten it, but he really misses the juice, you know. He misses going out and doing something that was dangerous and productive. I've had a very fortunate career, and I'm really grateful for it. If you have a little encouragement early, it's extremely helpful because you start to take your ideas seriously. And then in college, I had a couple professors who were very encouraging. I had a playwriting professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison before I transferred to UCLA, and he said, I like your plays. I do. I noticed they have about 37 scenes in them, some of which are on mountaintops or in submarines. I'm wondering, is this your medium? There's an expression in the Midwest, he's making a production out of himself. It seems presumptuous to assume that you can go write movies. And my early career in Hollywood was great, and there was a charmed quality to it. I started working early. My first movie was when I was 24. And through various people, I met Casey Silver, who was the head of production at Universal at the time, and he read one of my early scripts and hired me to an overall deal. And, he gave another of my scripts to Bob Zemeckis, who made it into Death Becomes Her. And then Steven Spielberg heard about me from Casey and Bob and hired me to write Jurassic Park, and it became the biggest movie of all time. And this was all like before I was 30. I tell these stories somewhat reluctantly because they tend to not make people like you very much. I'm sorry it worked out so well so quickly. Please know that I have had my share of suffering since that time. It was an incredible period. I got lucky in meeting some people who were, talented and encouraging. It was a sort of delicious era, and there were a lot of opportunities. In a way, I feel less of now, which is also a reason I wanted to write my book, Cold Storage, available now, because it was a chance for total freedom and to tell exactly a story I wanted in the way I wanted and let it sort of hopefully breeze through unfettered to the reader. It's a rough game, screenwriting. What's hardest about it is you're hired for your ideas and originality and then immediately asked to ameliorate them. After about the third draft of anything, I have a moment where I kind of say goodbye to it. The first draft, you can get a lot, if it's well received, you get a lot of enthusiasm just for its novelty, but it has obvious problems because it's a first draft. A second draft usually is worse, because you're trying in good faith to address people's notes. You throw out things you shouldn't, you keep things you shouldn't, you take bad notes, you don't use the good one. You make a few mistakes. The third draft, you go back and say, okay, this really worked and I want to preserve that from the first draft. It tends to just sort of leaven nicely. After the third draft, it can get different or it can get worse, but it's not going to get better. What was incredibly liberating, actually kind of shocking to me about the book, it was the first time someone had talked to me, giving me notes, viewing the book as essentially mine instead of a script which they consider essentially theirs. And that was pretty delightful.
That was screenwriter David Koepp talking about his first novel, Cold Storage. He will be in conversation tonight with fellow screenwriter Kevin Walker as part of Live Talks LA. It's at the William Turner Gallery inside the Bergamot Station Arts Center in Santa Monica. And our conversation with David Koepp was produced by Take Two's Sue Carpenter. We're going to close with a quick update on the investigation into the boat fire over Labor Day weekend. The cause is still not determined, but today the Coast Guard issued new emergency safety requirements for passenger boats nationwide, calling on operators to review safety equipment and potential problems with power strips, extension cords, and lithium batteries. During the investigation, questions have been raised about whether the fire started at a charging station for cameras, phones, and other electronics. KPC will have more on that later this afternoon, so stay tuned. All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. If you missed any part of the show, you can always find us wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for us, Take Two, and there we will be waiting to be listened to by you. You can also find us on social media at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me there as well at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.